Jeff Timmer is former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. Mark Brewer is former chair of the Michigan Democrats. And this is a republic, if you can keep it, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
Welcome to another week of A Republic, If You Can Keep It. I'm Jeff Timmer. Later in the podcast, Mark Brewer and I will be joined by our special guest, political analyst and fellow Lincoln Project advisor, Tara Suttmeyer. But as always, we begin with some of the politics of last week. Mark, let's start with your thoughts on Carl Levin, a legend in not just Michigan politics, but in U.S. politics. You don't find politicians like Carl Levin very often. And, you know, his passing has caused an outpouring of sentiment from both sides of the aisle. And I want to get your thoughts. You knew him well. And
yeah, I mean, what do you say about Carl Levin? Just, you know, 36 remarkable years serving Michigan and the nation, really, in the Senate. You know, he'll easily be ranked among the handful of really influential U.S. senators from Michigan. You know, and I go back a century, people like Zachariah Chandler, who helped found the National Republican Party, Arthur Vandenberg, you know, great isolationist, the middle of the last century, and of course, Phil Hart. But I think whenever now anybody talks about great Michigan United States senators, Carl Levin has to be in that group, you know, and just so much. He took all of his responsibilities as a senator so seriously. You know, most famously, of course, he served on the Armed Services Committee. But he took foreign affairs very seriously. His oversight responsibilities on the permanent committee on investigations, just the remarkable things he did there. And I think I can tell you, for me as a lawyer, but also when I was chair, just watching him, the tremendous impact he had on putting high quality federal judges on the bench. And he continued to have that interest. A little anecdote here. After Carl retired, I ran into him at Wayne State. And it was in the middle of the litigation we had a few years ago about straight party voting. And Carl wanted to know from me, standing in a hallway at Wayne State, Mark, how did each of these judges on the Sixth Circuit react to that appeal? What did they say? What did they do? I mean, just the keen interest that he had in all of that. But in the other perspective, in tremendous constituent service, tremendous. I used to run into his staff all around the state. People knew they could get that great constituent service. But also, too, you'd run into Carl around the state. Sometimes he'd drive himself to events. Sometimes Barbara would be with him. No staff. They'd come to an event, you know, work the crowd, pay attention to everybody, and then get in the car and go home. Just, you know, speaking, he always spoke from the heart. He was able to take the most complex topics that he had to deal with and convert them into something that was understandable, whether you were one-on-one with him or at a convention. And I'm just going to close with this, how I first met Carl Levin. 1978, he's running for the Senate. It's in the primary. And I attend a fundraiser for him at a good friend's home in Sterling Heights. After the fundraiser, Jeff, he takes off his shoes and plays volleyball with us in his stocking feet. But that's the kind of guy he was. He just joined in on the fun, you know, and just did it, right? Didn't put on airs. You know, I'm the city council president or the, you know, Detroit city council president. I'm running for Senate. That's beneath me. No, he liked to have fun. In addition to doing all that great work. So I'm going to stop here because I'm going to start crying. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of what a remarkable, remarkable person he was.
He's not somebody I knew well. I had cause to interact with him and speak with him in recent years on a bipartisan project. And I, you know, I called him up out of the blue to get him involved in something involving U.S. foreign aid. And, you know, I was talking to him and I kept saying, you know, Senator, he said, let me stop you there. Just call me Carl. And, you know, I've seen other people with that similar story. No, just call me Carl, a guy who had every right to put on airs. You know, he was, you know, in his 80s by that point. I'm younger than he is. Let's put it that way, by a considerably. And, he had served at the highest levels of politics, and, he could have just sat there and let me call him senator and take him in. But now he wanted to make the point of saying, hey, just call me Carl. I don't think we're going to see somebody else like him didn't agree on policy issues, but it's hard to fault him as a person. Everybody talks about how decent and kind he was. He could be a fierce, partisan, fight for his positions, but never a guy you could personally dislike. And that seems to be the universal theme as people describe his life. And I think what we won't see are electoral margins like he was able to rack up. When you look at his final Senate race in 2008, I think it was, and I think, got effectively 2/3 of the vote in Michigan. That's probably a margin we're not going to see again for a while. And that speaks to the kind of crossover appeal that he was able to build, because that means a lot of people who didn't support his policies still voted for him because they respected him.
Right. And you just look at the opponents he had. I mean, beating an incumbent United States Senator in 78. And then remember, astronaut Jack Lausma ran against him.
That's right.
Bill Shooting ran against him. Right. And it was just remarkable. And Carl was always great because he would say, well, my opponent's tall, dark, and handsome, but I'm short, stocky, but there's more of us than there are of them. Right. Because he was an everyday kind of person. And I think that's really what appealed to me. And Jeff, you're absolutely right. I run into people, obviously I know a lot of Republicans over the years, and they would say, I don't agree with Carl Levin on very much at all, but he's a straight shooter, he's principled, and I'm going to vote for the guy. And that happened over and over and over again. It was just remarkable.
And one of his wins was against Ronna Romney. He took on the Romney name and beat her soundly. I think he exceeded 60% in his race in 1996 against Ronna Romney Sr. The Levin dynasty beat the Romney dynasty.
Well, and again, it's just a remarkable family on both sides. I worked for Justice Charles Levin of the Michigan Supreme Court, Carl's cousin. Of course, Carl's brother, Sandy, an enormous, tremendous life in politics. Sandy's son, Andy. Now,
guest recently on our podcast.
Right. And just a remarkable family in terms of the dedication to public service. Just models of what public service should be.
Mark and Jeff will be right back with political commentator Tara Settmeyer after these messages.
The Michigan Polycast. It's been called one of Michigan's top political podcasts by Hourly Detroit.
Each week, longtime political junkies Christine Barry and Walt Sorg offer news and views on Michigan politics and policy, as well as national issues impacting our pleasant peninsulas. And they are joined by some of the state's biggest names from government, politics, academia, and nonprofit groups, with an in-depth look at those issues.
Subscribe now to the Michigan Polycast, online at www.michiganpolycast.com.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, federal, state, and local issues. Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, and local governments across the state. When it comes to measuring voter opinions, Epic MRA has been known as the go-to Michigan pollster for over 25 years. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Our guest today is Tara Settmeyer. Tara is a former CNN political commentator, contributor to ABC News, and a former Republican communications director on Capitol Hill. She's appeared on ABC's The View, ABC's Good Morning America, and on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher. In 2020, she was named a Harvard Institute of Politics Spring Resident Fellow. Also in 2020, she joined the Lincoln Project as a senior advisor and hosts the live show, The Breakdown, along with co-founder Rick Wilson on Lincoln Project's streaming channel, LPTV.
In 2017, Settmeyer was named as a board director for Stand Up Republic, a nonprofit organization formed in the wake of the 2016 election of Donald Trump to unite Americans behind the defense of democratic norms, ideals, and institutions. Setmeyer focuses her Tell It Like It Is commentary and analysis on political issues that impact America's future. During the 2016 presidential cycle, she earned the reputation of being an outspoken conservative critic of Donald Trump and challenged his surrogates on the veracity of their claims. Vulture.com recognized her as one of 2016's top 20 election coverage stars on TV.
Tara, it's a pleasure to have you join the conversation on A Republic, If You Can Keep It. You know, there's so much to talk about always in this crazy upside down political world we live in. But, you know, I was watching the breakdown on LPTV last week, the night of the hearings, I think it was, when the hearings had started. You and Rick Wilson just had a very, great conversation about the police officer's testimony. And I just wanted to begin the conversation there with the No, what the hell is going on with the Republican revisionism? I tweeted earlier today that not all of the Republicans, in fact, not many, were part of the coup attempt on January 6th. But in the aftermath, nearly every one of them has signed up to become part of it. And so that's the astonishing part, how a failed coup attempt and people kind of say, hey, wait, I now want a piece of that. I want to be part of that. I want to be part of the cover up. I just want to get your thoughts on, you know, where we're at and what happens from here.
You know, that day, January 6th, hit me really hard, not only just as an American watching insurrectionists, violent insurrectionists breach the Capitol and deface our Capitol and, you know, walk through with a Confederate flag and Camp Auschwitz shirts and all the other just vile things that we saw that day, a gallows set up on the west lawn of the Capitol, chanting, you know, hang Mike Pence. The litany of atrocities that happened that day are long. What happened to those police officers and the law enforcement officers who were there defending our, not only our Capitol, but defending the seat of our government, the very foundation of our democracy. It hit me really hard. Because I was a Capitol Hill staffer for many years. I've lived in the Washington, D.C. area for over 20 years. I went to George Washington University. So from the time I was a babe in the woods, you know, conservative Republican, very wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, I'd been in Washington, D.C., enamored with our history here and the power, the epicenter of the world's greatest democracy. So watching that, I just couldn't believe what was going on. And my heart hurt. It was breaking that day. I went through a range of emotions, from anger to gut-wrenching heartbreak to just astonishment. And I also, it hit me personally because I'm married to a federal law enforcement officer who was working that day, not at the Capitol. He was down by the White House in the Ellipse. He's a 20-year veteran federal officer. And I grew up in a law enforcement family. My grandfather was captain of my hometown police department and retired after 40 years. So I bleed blue. You know, I'm that person that Blue Lives Matter, back the blue. And, you know, 4th of July parades were a big tradition in my family. And, you know, that just all of that, you know, red-blooded American patriotism stuff that was part of the impetus for what attracted me to conservatism and the Republican Party when I was a teenager. All of that it seems foreign now. I mean, Jeff, you know, this is not the Republican Party. It's not your father's Republican Party. It's not my Republican Party. I'm 45. You know, what the hell happened here? And then I thought for sure, you know, after watching 4.5 years, almost five at that point, of Republicans selling out to Donald Trump just because they wanted to keep their elected office and they figured that was the only way to do it, and just watching each people that I respected, that I worked with, who I'd known for many years, who I thought were tried and true conservatives, just sell their souls one after the other. I thought for sure this would be it. Finally, this is the off ramp, right? I mean, the freaking guy incited a violent insurrection against our government. It doesn't get much more treasonous than that. And yet they did not. Not only did they not repudiate him fully and finally say enough is enough, they continued to triple down on this big lie about the election being stolen and that somehow Joe Biden's presidency was illegitimate. To this day, I still cannot believe that this is where the Republican Party has gone.
Well, and then you have, like, you know, chumps like Kevin McCarthy, who showed the righteous anger and indignation in the wake of, you know, during the moment that the coup attempt was going on January 6th and his phone calls with Trump. But in the aftermath, on the day of the impeachment vote, call, you know, blaming Trump, laying the responsibility at Trump's feet. And now it's just kind of it's like the Soviet erasure of history, like that never happened.
Yeah.
It's just like, no, I never said that. Right. I mean, he's like full throated, you know, it's Nancy Pelosi's fault. She was behind the insurrection. And, you know, this complete absurd, fairy tale, you know, dark fairy tale that they're trying to spin. You're right. For the sake of power and maintaining, or trying to regain the majority, quickly did a nose count and realized that they've got 211 members of that caucus, more than half of whom are completely batshit crazy, and are actually believing this stuff. And the rest of them, it's not a deal breaker for them. They're willing to go along with it. You know, there's only the 10 who voted for impeachment, maybe the 35 who voted for the original bipartisan January 6th commission when they had a chance to, you know, kind of control part of it, that showed a flash of character, an ounce of courage. But there just is none left in the Republican Party.
It's astonishing. It really is, because, you know, it wasn't just McCarthy. It was Lindsey Graham. Remember, it's been a great ride, but I'm done. Right.
And Mitch McConnell. Sure.
Mitch McConnell gave the floor speech of his life. You know, we actually saw, you know, he actually looked like he had blood flowing through his veins that day, and gave a floor speech for the ages. And yet that all went out the window as soon as they realized, like you said, they did the numbers and they said, holy shit, we can't get reelected. We're going to lose the house. You know, we already lost the house, but we're not going to get it back. We're going to be a permanent minority if we get rid of Trump, because he's not going away. And they created that monster by not repudiating his nonsense early on. You know, the Republicans screwed this up back in the primaries in 2016 and 2015 when they let him get away with disrespecting John McCain and making racist and xenophobic comments and saying things that were just anathema to what we thought the Republicans stood for. But nobody stood up to this guy. And I just thought, like, even back then, I'm like, somebody's going to stand up. Like, there's no way they're going to let him get away with this. And that never happened. And then, of course, there were way too many people running vanity candidacies in 2016 that split the vote and let him win in the primary. And then that ship was, you know, sailed. And unfortunately, you had the naivety of McConnell and Paul Ryan thinking they were going to control Donald Trump. Listen, I'm from New Jersey. I grew up in North Jersey reading the tabloids and, you know, with Donald Trump in New York and, you know, what he did in Atlantic City. And I already knew that this guy was full of it. I knew that he was a huckster. I knew he was a con artist and a laughingstock in the business community. So I wasn't falling for it, but he was very good at convincing lots of people that watched him would create this persona, this false persona on The Apprentice, and this, you know, he was a genius at marketing, say what you will about him, but he understands how to manipulate people's attitudes and marketing things. And, you know, here we are. I mean, it was Voltaire who said that those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. That's exactly what we're seeing happen right now. And that is the power of communication and the power of never paying a price or consequence for your actions. I blame the enablers. I blame the Mark Meadows and McCarthy's and the McConnell's and all the other people who stood by, the Marco Rubio's and Ted Cruz's and all of these sanctimonious Republicans who walked around with their pocket constitutions and talked about the separation of powers and all of these things and rule of law and the Constitution, that stood back and let Donald Trump run roughshod over all of them and completely destroy any moral high ground that they had It's gone. They're completely bankrupt and have no leg to stand on because they let Donald Trump get away with all of this and then try to justify and rationalize it.
Sarah, I want to pick up on your great point that you just made about enabling, you know, politically enabling, you know, what has happened here. A few weeks ago, we had Congressman Dan Kildee on from a Michigan congressman. And he speculated, and I'd like to hear from you on this, that beyond the enabling you've described, that he thinks there are actually members of the Republican caucus in the House who are in communication with the insurrectionists on January 6th.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the reasons they are so opposed to any investigation is because they're trying to cover up their own role in it beyond the political enabling you discussed. What do you think about that idea? Oh,
I agree 100%. There's a reason why when you see a collective hysteric freak out that's irrational, like what we're seeing from the Republicans in response to the January 6th commission, you know that there's more than just what we see on the surface. It's not just politics. They have personal things at stake here, including McCarthy himself. We all know that McCarthy was in contact with Trump that day, begging him to do something about it. And we know that because a Congresswoman Herrera Butler was courageous enough to come out and say, yeah, I witnessed it. I was there. Because, you know, McCarthy never would have said anything because he's a coward. He's a coward like the rest of them. And so, you know, she was, when she saw that, she was courageous enough to vote for impeachment, recognizing that what this guy has done is completely against everything their oaths of office represent. You also had Peter Meyer from your home state, right? He's from Michigan. He was another, he took Justin Amash's seat, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So he was another one with that maverick, attitude, like Justin Amash, kind of independent thinker that stood up as a freshman and did the right thing. But there was only 10 out of 211. You've got to be kidding me, you know? And but we also know that you've got the Kook caucus. You've got Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Andy Biggs, Paul Gosar, Mo Brooks. These people are Madison Cawthorn, another joke. Like, these people are a disgrace to their oaths of office. They shouldn't be, you know, paid by the taxpayers. And I don't know what their constituents are thinking, but they voted them in. But they need to be held accountable for whatever roles they played. I mean, we know that there were more and more is coming out now about who gave tours the day before, who was in communication that day. And if you have a commission with subpoena power that can get these phone records, and we'll find out. That's why they didn't want it. You know, this, what happened on January 6th is another 9/11 style attack on this country. You may not have had the same loss of life, but the attack on our democracy, we have never seen a non-peaceful transition of power in this country until that day. A Confederate flag never was hoisted and walked through our Capitol, even during the Civil War, for goodness sakes. So these things happened, and they're trying to whitewash it and minimize it and downplay it because they don't want the American people to really fully embrace what happened that day and who was behind it and any of the people who were involved, because then they have to pay a price, maybe get kicked out of Congress. And they should. You know, we had Paul Gosar's siblings on the breakdown, Rick Wilson and I did on LPTV recently, and three of them. And they believe their own brother should be prosecuted and held to account for his role in being in contact with the organizers of the Stop the Steal movement, and the role that he played in helping facilitate that. I mean, Mo Brooks told people to go kick ass, for goodness sakes. I mean, there's so much, the paper trail, I think, here is concerning to them, and McCarthy doesn't want to deal with having to possibly kick out a couple people in his own caucus who were, you know, I call them unindicted co-conspirators of a violent insurrection against our government.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned the Kook caucus, you know, the most visible members of the freak show that is the Republicans in Congress. But to me, I think that the collective freakout means that there's probably people more prominent and less known who are at risk here, because I think they'd be willing to saw the log off, the branch off behind, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene or Boebert, because that would settle some bigger problems. But I think the fact that they've you know, kind of circled the wagons means that there's, it goes deeper, that there's other people involved, maybe people, you know, more prominent in leadership and the party, that this isn't just those, the people that are, you know, kind of trotted out on the, you know, cable news and Newsmax and OAN. This is much more traditional folks who are exposed here.
We all know. Let's be honest. This goes all the way to the White House. Mm-hmm. We know that Donald Trump sat on his hands and watched with glee as that violent insurrection took place in their name. We know this. We know that he said to McCarthy that, well, it looks like these people are more upset about the election than you are. We heard his own words that day where he said, "We love you," called them patriots. We know that Donald Trump tried to install a bunch of his acolytes and people who were completely unqualified for their job in the Pentagon that alarmed our leadership at the Pentagon, the civilian leadership and the Joint Chiefs. We know, you know, General Milley was very concerned about what was going on at the Pentagon. Trump knew exactly what he was doing. We had Michael Cohen on our show a couple of weeks ago as well. And Michael Cohen said, absolutely, Donald Trump got off watching that it was probably better than sex for him. That was his quote.
Okay? Yeah, he said something. He was on the podcast a few weeks ago and he said something similar. So,
yeah. Right. And so, you know, that doesn't surprise any of us. If you've read Mary Trump's book about how sadistic Donald Trump is, it all fits. So, of course, they, you know, what do you do when you find out that the president of the United States sat back and was gleeful as a bunch of his violent insurrectionist followers, cultists, because I've said for a long time that this has turned into a cult. Now it's a death cult, the way people are behaving around COVID. But how do you think it looks when he sits back and with glee and is okay with them going after the vice president of the United States? We saw the video. That January 6th hearing, we saw, you know, portions of video that hadn't been public before where they were talking about coming, you know, "We're going to kill you, traitor," Mike Pence. One of the most loyal, like sickening, nauseating loyalists of Donald Trump throughout his, who never, you know, stood up to anything. And he was an apostate. He was the traitor because they wanted him to do something unconstitutional. That's how sick these people are. It goes back to the Voltaire quote, you know, that those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And that's exactly what we saw.
Now we saw that, you know, recently the notes at the Justice Department, as Trump was calling them.
That's right.
Saying, look, you all just say that the election was corrupt, and then I and the Republican congressman will take care of it.
Well, right, leave it to us.
Yeah, who are the Republican congressmen he was referring to? Jim Jordan?
Jim Jordan, McCarthy, that was
himself,
one.
These other co-conspirators? I think
so that's, there were notes. Yeah. There were more notes on that, and Jim Jordan was one of them. And so, you know, you wonder why Nancy Pelosi said, oh, hell no, Jim Jordan's not going to be on this select committee. That was a no-brainer. And I have to say, as someone who battled, you know, the Democrats and Nancy Pelosi for many years on the other side, that I am actually, you know, I can say now that she is handling her job as speaker really well. She is a boss. Nancy Pelosi, I would take Nancy Pelosi and my political team any day. She is a political brinkman. You know, she understands how things work, and she's really using her power as speaker to assert herself in a way that is actually in the best interest of the country. I don't agree with their policies, and I never will. That's why I'm not a Democrat. I left the Republican Party officially after the election this year. Once I saw that there was no hope for these people, once I saw Donald Trump was calling the election into question and Mitch McConnell and the leaders of the party didn't stand up and say, stop this. I mean, the conservative movement that I grew up on was, you know, the thought leaders like Bill Buckley, who said that conservatives' role was to yell stop athwart history when no one else would. Well, where was that? No one yelled stop, even when the president of the United States, standing in the east wing of the White House, called the election a fraud and say the only way that he could lose is if it was fraudulent. That to me was, that was it. And no one said anything about that. I was done. I said, there's no hope for these people anymore. And I'm going to have to fight this battle from the outside. And if that means a new party or, you know, I don't know what that means, but I can no longer associate myself with an R next to my name with this level of apostasy. It's just unconstitutional. We're borderline authoritarian at this point. You know, I'm a big fan of Anne Applebaum, if anyone reads her, but she, you know, she talks about the seductive lure of authoritarianism. And that's what we're seeing. And it's not only happening here, it's happening across the West. You look, see what's happening in Hungary and Belarus and, you know, other places in, you know, Brazil and other places where you see these right-wing leaders emerging and mirroring themselves after Donald Trump and kind of what he's doing. They look, hey, if they can get away with it in America, then we can get away with it too. And that's a very dangerous trend that we're seeing. It's literally the dismantling of democracy right in front of our faces. And more of us have to continue to yell, stop athwart history, or else we're going to lose our democracy.
Yeah, my kids like to tell their friends that I've spent the last 30 years in prison rather than admit I worked in Republican politics. It's much less embarrassing for them.
Yeah.
I'll stick up for you, Jeff. But Tara, if I could turn the conversation a little different direction, you know, you are law enforcement through and through. You know, we know that about you. You said that as we opened up. What has all of this done to the relationship between the Republican Party and law enforcement? A very close relationship over the years, politically and otherwise. One of the pillars of the Republican Party was supporting law enforcement. You know, but now we see how these officers on Capitol Hill have been treated, and their brothers and sisters in blue as well. If I can, I really want to know, you know, from you, what's your sense of now the relationship between the Republican Party and law enforcement in this country?
You know, to quote Officer Fanone, it's a disgrace. You know, it's disgraceful the way these Republicans have treated these officers and dishonored their service. Talking about this last Tuesday after watching the hearing, it was very emotional watching the hearing again. And I broke down in tears on our show that night on the breakdown, and Rick Wilson was in tears too. Like, we were just so tears of just righteous anger, you know? And it's the level of hypocrisy is astounding. I don't ever want to hear another Republican say anything about, you know, defunding the police and going after Democrats for that, you know, which was nonsense anyway. And stand there as if they have some moral authority on law enforcement after the way they've treated the officers who bravely put their lives on the line to fight for them, and for them to turn around and tell them, oh, that didn't happen. You know, it was no different than an average tourist day and all this other nonsense, this Orwellian level of doublespeak. It is unconscionable. And I don't know if you're going to see support shift within law enforcement, because some of these people they're so conditioned now to believe that the Democrats and the left and liberals are just anti-police. You know, I mean, Democrats almost lost that election last year because of the law and order, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests and the ones that turned violent, and, you know, Portland and those places, you know, those were the small handful. Mostly it was peaceful protests, but those images of things being out of control, it was right out of the playbook of the Nixon law and order playbook in 68. And, you know, Trump's people they were aware of that and they knew it, and the Democrats didn't handle it well. So it was closer than people want to admit. So will this move the law enforcement community away from Republicans? I'm not so sure, because I'm not so sure that Democrats have nationalized this issue enough and used it. If they were smart in their individual districts, in the swing districts where that matters, where you need the suburban women and those votes, those middle of the road voters who need to be reminded that you're possibly voting for someone that is, you know, okay with calling a Capitol Police officer an executioner because he had to, unfortunately, take the life of an insurrectionist that was coming to do harm to our Capitol. I mean, if they're okay with that, that's on them. But the police unions have not been very vocal, speaking out against the way Republicans have handled this. So that doesn't give me, you know, any hope that there may be a full shift in that, because it hasn't been nationalized as an issue. And that's up to Democrats, the way they want to message it. In my opinion, they should remind people every day how Republicans have treated our public servants, because they put their lives on the line every day. You can't just trot them out and use them as political pawns when it's politically expedient for you. Republicans did that with the military. Trump did that with the military. And yet, you know, you had a lot of military folks still vote for him. But he lost some military support the second time around, but not enough, in my opinion.
Well, can't believe how quickly the conversation has gone and the time has flown, but I see that we are at the end of our time, and I want to thank you, Tara, for coming on and joining us. It's been a we've gone through some ups and downs. It can be depressing if we just think about where we are, but I think the fact that there's more of us than there are of them is what gives me hope and keeps me fighting. They're determined.
I say that often. There's more of us than them.
Thank you so much, Tara Stuttmeyer.
Well, thank you so much. And I just want to leave your listeners with a word of encouragement that, never be bullied into silence, because that's what they want. And that's the tactics that the other side has been using had worked for them for a long time. And we cannot be silent. You cannot sit back and be silent and just complacent about what's going on around you, in particular on local levels. Sometimes we get caught up in what's happening nationally, and that matters. But what really matters right now is paying attention to what happens on a state and local level. We see what Republicans are trying to do. They are using, different tactics when people aren't paying attention in off years, and changing election laws and installing their, their own loyalists. And, Trumpism is still alive and well, and it's malignant. It is a malignancy that is trying to destroy our democracy, and we can't let it. And to your point, Jeff, there are more of us than them, but we have to be better at mobilizing, better at activating our people who are pro-democracy. And we have to put country over party, because otherwise we're not going to have a country. The parties won't matter. The arguments over the deficit and taxes, none of that will matter if our democracy falls. But if it falls, it's on us, because we are the ones that control it. They work for us. So for folks, if you thought you never could get involved, or your vote didn't matter, or you can't do anything, that's not true. Every single person in this effort matters. So if you want your republic, we have a republic if you can keep it, but that's up to me and you.
Thanks so much.
And that's the end note for this week. As always, we invite your comments and questions. Email us at comments@arepublicpodcast.com.
Or you can add your comments on our Facebook page or via our website. If the Republic is still standing, we will be back in a week. I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on your favorite podcast app. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.